This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. There's a moment in Marcelo Gleiser's new book where the Dartmouth astrophysicist goes deep. So deep, I'm not sure I can follow. He's talking about topology, a branch of geometry that studies how spaces can be continuously deformed into one another. For example, he writes, a ball with no holes in it can be deformed into a football-shaped ellipsoid, a cube, or a pear. But it cannot be deformed into a donut. A ball with one hole in it can be deformed into any hat, as long as the hat has one hole. A donut can be deformed into a mug with a handle. End quote. Okay, my brain just exploded. A ball can be a pear, but not a donut? But a donut can be a mug with a handle. Whoa, this sounds like Homer Simpson logic. But it's actually a branch of science and mathematics that has helped us understand the structure of the universe. It's one of those areas of understanding that has been developed over time as technology and our body of knowledge grow together. In The Island of Knowledge, The Limits of Science and the Search for Meaning, Marcelo Gleiser explores how much we can know about everything, and whether or not science can actually explain everything, given enough time, or if there will always be depths we cannot plumb, shores we will never reach. Marcelo Gleiser can explain it all better himself, and he joins me today. Professor Gleiser, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Thank you so much for having me again.
So can you explain how a donut can be a mug with a handle?
Yeah, sure. You can do that with Play-Doh. You know, you get a ball of Play-Doh, okay, and you make a hole in it. And then you can very easily transform that Play-Doh with the hole in it into a mug. So the idea is that the mug has only one hole, which is this handle that we have there. So topology is basically like a game that you play with shapes. And what controls what you can deform into is the number of holes that you have in that surface. So that's the idea. And so the case of the donut that has one hole, well, the mug only has one hole as well, which is the handle where you hold on to.
Right. And where you actually pour the liquid in, that's not a hole. That's just a concave spot.
Exactly. Exactly. That's exactly the trick. And that's why it's like, what? Can you really do that? But you can, because there is really only one hole in the mug.
And this is, as you said, something that I suppose even children can figure out, given enough time, that you know, with one hole, these are the shapes you can make.
Exactly. You know, a lot of science and science learning is about playfulness, is about how you play with shapes and with numbers. And so what's really amazing is that you can apply these ideas to big concepts like the universe itself.
Well, let's go right there, exploring the universe itself and trying to get into the depths of what we know and what we don't know. Where do you start that approach?
Well, the central metaphor of this book, I think, is, you know, as all metaphors, it's never perfect, but it's at least I would imagine that it's very inspiring for people to understand the idea, is this notion of the island of knowledge. So imagine that everything that we know fits in an island. And the knowledge here does not necessarily include only scientific knowledge. It could be any other kinds of knowledge. You know, you can talk about artistic creations, whatever. But let's focus on the scientific knowledge of the world. So let's say this is our island. And clearly, you know, as we discover more and more about nature, this island grows. But the question is, what is surrounding this island? Well, it's what I call the ocean of the unknown. So the idea that around knowledge, there is this ocean of what we do not know about nature. And here comes the surprise, which is as the island grows, and sometimes it can even retract when we find that something we knew about the world actually was wrong. But as the island grows, so do the shores of our ignorance, the boundary between the island and the ocean. And what that means is the following, is that as we know more and more about the world through the tools that we use, through the ideas and models that we construct, we become equipped with knowledge that allows us to ask questions that we couldn't even have thought about before. So science and all the pursuit of knowledge becomes sort of an endless frontier.
Yeah, you say that our view of the world is really just a fraction of the reality that's actually out there. So can you give us an example, or is this one of those situations where we don't know what we don't know, so you can't give me an example of what we don't know?
No, I can give you so many examples, you know, and I'm very happy you asked that. So just to start with, you know, the Little Prince, right? The book by Antoine Saint-Exupéry. There was a point in the book where the fox says to the little prince that what is essential is invisible to the eye. And that is so true in the sciences as well. So if you take a trip back in time to say 300 years ago, what we knew of reality, you know, reality being what we can say about the world around us, was profoundly different from what we know now. For example, what we knew then was basically what we could gather from our five senses. You know, you saw things, you heard things, you touched things, and that was about it. However, there is this whole realm of the invisible around us. For example, the radio waves that are transmitting the signals for your program are a kind of electromagnetic radiation, which is very similar to visible light, but our eyes cannot catch it. There is a lot that our sense cannot see or hear. So the notion is that as we probe into this unknown, this invisible world, we use tools to do that. And right now, you're being bombarded by all sorts of things. For example, every second, there is about 1 trillion, and I'm not exaggerating, 1 trillion, that means 1,000 billion neutrinos, little particles coming from the heart of the sun. They are going through you and through everybody that is listening to this program and everybody else in a second. And we have no clue about this thing because neutrinos, they pass through almost like ghosts through matter. But if you have the right detectors, you can see that. So you can imagine that all the things that we cannot detect, they are unseen and are still there as part of this unknown reality around us.
One of the things that you say in the book that I loved thinking about is that there's no such thing as an exact measurement. You know, when you get down to it, you can never get small enough to get exact. And that's sort of some of where you're going here. I just love thinking about that.
Right. So this is a very good thing to think about and to kind of ground us a little bit. Every tool has a precision limit, right? So when you say you weigh yourself, right, and you're using a scale and the smallest division on that scale is about, say, half a pound. So you will not know your weight with a precision of about a quarter of a pound. So it's about half of the smallest division. So, and, you know, the same thing that works for a scale works for every kind of tool that we use in science, including very sophisticated tools. And that means that when you look out, say, let's go big here, when you look out into the universe and you look at stars and you look at faraway galaxies, you're seeing a lot of stuff, but you're also not seeing a lot of stuff, which go beyond not just the limit of the precision that you can measure stuff, but that are out of the range that your instruments can probe.
But why then, I mean, why do you say, though, that there's an absolute limitation on how much we can know of the physical world? I mean, in theory, couldn't we get measurements that were so specific? Or why is there an absolute limit?
So that's a very good question. So there are two kinds of limitations to how much we can know about physical reality. One is the tools themselves, as you said, you know, but as we progress, right, as we advance, technologies advance, etc., our tools are getting better and better, and you can see more and more. But notice that you can never see all. So that's one point. But then there is the other one, and this is the real tough one, which is the fact that nature itself offers us limits to how much we can understand of it. Here's a very basic example, the speed of light. So the speed of light is the fastest thing that exists in nature, right? So it's in numbers 186,000 miles per second, which means really nothing to people. But one way that I think about the speed of light is you blink your eye and light goes 7.5 times around the Earth. Okay, in the blink of an eye, boom, 7.5 times around the Earth. And it takes about 8 minutes for light to come from the sun to us, which basically means that if the sun would explode right now, we would only find out in 8 minutes. Mm-hmm. And it would be the last thing you would know, of course, right? Because that'll be it. But the point is that information takes time to get to us. So if you put that together with the fact that the universe has a finite age, the universe has been with us or has been around for 13.8, let's make it round numbers, 14 billion years. light can only have traveled so far within this time, which basically means something kind of interesting, which is that we live in the center of a bubble of information, which is how much we can perceive of the universe. Now, just like the horizon at a beach, you know, the ocean may continue after what you can see, the line of the horizon, but you cannot see beyond that. The same thing happened to us with the universe. We cannot see beyond our cosmic bubble.
We have a listener question. Santiago, who's writing in from North Carolina, wants you to keep going with this, go a little bit deeper. He says, I've read in your book how the atom known in 1920 is different from the atom known in the 50s and how that differs from our picture of the atom at the present. However, there should be a limit to knowledge, right? Santiago says, after probing deeper and deeper, we should get to a point where there is no deeper. Or do you think the quest for the smallest, the largest, the foundational foundation, etc., could in theory go on endlessly? And what would that mean for science?
That is a really good question. And the honest answer to that question is we cannot know. We do not know if there is a limit to how small things go. We, in physics, we claim that there is an absolute smallness to things, which is called the Planck length, okay, for Max Planck, the man who started quantum physics, which is basically the smallest distance where we can make sense of the concept of space and also of time. So that length is ridiculously small. It's about 10 to minus 33 centimeters, which is, you know, let's see, 20 zeros smaller than an atom. Now, the point is that is, in a sense, the final stumbling block. You know, in principle, from what we know now of the world, we cannot go smaller than that. But we are so far in particle physics from probing that kind of distance and that kind of energy that we have a huge ocean of discovery ahead of us. So from our perspective, you know, we can never say never in science. It's not a very good word to use in science. But we can say from our perspective, from what we know now of the world, this pursuit for understanding the very small and the very large is pretty much endless.
I love that idea of the Planck length. That's such a cool concept. We're talking today with Dartmouth Professor of Physics and Astronomy, Marcelo Gleiser. He's sharing his view that science perhaps will never be able to account for everything in the universe and beyond, that the more we understand, the more there is that remains unknown or unknowable. Listeners, we'd love to know what you think about this idea and what questions you have for Professor Gleiser. You can call 1-800-639-2211 or post your questions on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today we are talking about the search for knowledge and for meaning, whether those are mutually exclusive or complementary, and what our limits of understanding might be. Marcelo Gleiser is our guest. He's a professor of physics and astronomy at Dartmouth College, and his latest book is called The Island of Knowledge, The Limits of Science and the Search for Meaning. Let us know what questions you have for Professor Gleiser. Call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your questions or your thoughts about this discussion on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Let's go to Gordon, who's calling in from Killington. Hi, Gordon. Go ahead.
Yes. Hi. How are you today?
Great.
I had a question about what Einstein had discovered, because of what we thought of the universe and the world around us was completely turned on its head and upside down with the four papers that he published in 1 year, and how the time travel is possible and whatnot, and how that has affected the future of physics and what we know about the universe and astronomy.
Gordon, thanks for the call. Professor Gleiser?
So you're referring to the four papers Einstein wrote when he was 26-year-old in working in Bern in a patent office. And yes, those were absolutely amazing papers. And two of them were about the special theory of relativity, you know, the one that talks about the special theory of relativity, just to connect to my previous discussion, is the one that uses the fact that light is the most, the fastest speed on nature to kind of rethink the whole notion of space and time. So you're right. So Einstein used a concept which is actually, you know, we talk about the theory of relativity by saying everything is relative, and that's really not what the theory of relativity is. It's based on actually two absolutes, which is the laws of nature are the same for every observer. So if I'm standing on a sidewalk, and if you're coming by in a car at 60 miles an hour, we should have the same laws of nature. And that the second absolute is that the speed of light is the same for everyone. And that is really weird, right? Because when you kick a ball, right, from if you're not running, the ball is going to have a certain speed. But if you're running and then you throw the ball is going to have the speed that you threw it with plus your running speed. So things add up. But light is completely different. And light is and has been, for Einstein and for everybody else, the greatest mystery, in a sense, you know, that what is light exactly? We know what to do with it. We work with it all the time. But the nature of light remains a big unknown, so to speak. So the example of Einstein is a very good one because it shows how an individual, based on his intuition, and, you know, the other papers were more grounded than what was going on at the scientific community at the time, but how it is possible to reconstruct a narrative of reality, you know, what is space, what is time, what is matter, what is energy, almost like unexpectedly, right? And then we have to rethink all these things that we thought we knew so well, given this new framework of thinking about this idea.
Well, go ahead. You were
going to. No, I was just going to say, and that is very typical of how science advances. You know, so science is a narrative that we are constructing to make sense of nature, of physical reality. And as we advance our tools, as we advance our models, those ideas, those narratives, the concepts that we use to construct this story, so to speak, of the world, change as well.
But if we accept your premise that we will never know everything and that the shores of what we don't know around our island of knowledge grow bigger as our depth of knowledge grows bigger, if we can never know everything, what's the point? What are we trying to get to, if not the bottom of things?
Oh, I'm so happy you asked that question, because whenever I talk about, oh, you know, I'm sorry, folks, but, you know, there are limits to what we can know of the universe through science, they will say, oh, but what? That's such a downer. You know, I mean, why are you even doing this to us? You know, we want to know everything. And I say, no, you know, I'm going to turn this exactly upside down. I'm going to say, what is a downer is to actually think that there is a limit to how much you can know, and that you can actually get there. Can you imagine how horrible if suddenly we said, okay, that's it. We understand everything there is to understand. We can just go home and play golf now. I mean, that would be, to me, much more depressing than saying, look, nature is amazing. Nature is full of surprises. We humans have done so much to understand how it works, but there is so much more that we do not understand. So come on, get into this boat, and let's all try to figure out things about nature without imagining the idea or even thinking about the idea that there is an end to things. Because honestly, from a philosophical perspective, you cannot say that. Okay, so it's not just this motivational speech that science is wonderful because we never get to an end of things. We only kind of in the journey of understanding things. But from an epistemological perspective, that is from the way we understand the world, we can't get to the end simply because of the limits that both our tools are offering and that nature itself is offering to our understanding.
But isn't it human nature to at least think that there's an end that we're trying to reach? I mean, if you say this is a race without end, won't people quit? I mean, you still want to believe, even if you're not going to reach it, that you are striving towards some goal at the end.
Right. So that notion, the goal at the end, perhaps is the wrong notion. Mm. You know, it's not the goal at the end. It's the many goals that we are going to achieve as we move forward in life and as we move forward in our process of trying to understand things. To me, you know, if you reach the top of a mountain that is very high, what do you want to do next? You want to go to a higher one. And that's essentially how science goes. You know, and if you reach the top of the highest mountain, then you take a rocket ship and you go to another planet. The point being that if you set your goals into a single final destination, you're selling yourself short. You know, there is much more to human creativity than setting ourselves to that final destination. And from the perspective that I am explaining in the book in a lot of detail, you can't really set that goal. For example, okay, just to give a very famous example that people talk about a lot, this idea that is a theory of everything, right? That there is a theory of physics that in principle can encompass all the knowledge of how the particles of matter interact through the fundamental forces. So we say there are four forces of nature. There is gravity, there is electromagnetism, and there are two forces which act at the nucleus of the atom. So we can show perhaps that these four forces are manifestations of a single unified force, something that I kind of half-jokingly called monotheistic science. You know, you're basically trying to create sort of like a monotheistic version of our knowledge of nature. However, think back to what I mentioned about all the invisible stuff that we do not see. So to say that you can construct a final theory of the way the particles of matter interact is inconsistent with the fact that we cannot know if the four forces are the only forces of nature. So you can perhaps say something like this: hey, given what we know now, we can construct a theory that brings these four forces into a unified framework. However, 10, 15, 100, 1,000 years from now, somebody else will say, oops, I just found a fifth force and a sixth force, and you have to kind of rethink your unification. Well, perhaps it wasn't such a unification after all. And so it's much better to liberate ourselves from this burden of finding a final truth and instead looking for smaller gems of truth on the way.
So should we all be comfortable with the idea that perhaps the ground is shifting beneath us constantly, that what we think is real may or may not be real, and that we really can't trust anything, including perhaps what scientists are telling us?
Well, that's quite a statement. No, I think I don't want to go there at all. I think that science is the best way that we have to understand the world around us and to understand it in a universal language, a language that doesn't matter what you think about politics or what you think about religion, you can still share the scientific kind of knowledge. And we have done wonderful things with what we can understand about nature. For example, producing radio stations and transmitters that can make people here and across the world be listening to our words right now. However, to claim that science is the only way to understand things, or to claim that science is going to understand everything, is to me an article of faith and not really an article of how we understand the world through science, which is a fallible way of understanding nature.
Let's go to Howard, who's calling in from Plattsburgh, New York. Hi, Howard.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I want to ask about these deep mine particle detectors. I remember in the past they were once used for the detection of proton decay, which I don't know whether they were ever detected or not, and then neutrino detection, and now apparently for dark matter detection. How are these three entities related? Or okay, are the detectors actually different for each of these? Could you explain that?
Sure. So that's a very good question. So this is one way where we have these ideas about the universe and then we go test them in these amazing places. So these underground detectors tend to be built in very deep mines, you know, like 200, 300 yards, even more underground. And the reason you want to do that is to shield the detectors from the stuff you don't want. So, for example, I mentioned you have all these neutrinos coming through, but there are also a bunch of other particles that come down to us from the skies and even from the inside of the Earth through radioactive decay. So these mines are sort of like shields that protect the detectors, and they can focus on what you really want. So a good example of that is a detector in Japan called Kamiokande 2, which was designed to find proton decay. So one of the, funnily enough, one of the theories of everything, one of the theories that tries to unify electromagnetism, the weak and the strong nuclear forces, so three of the four, predicts that the proton, the particle that make up stuff, including us, is an unstable particle, that it could decay. So if this theory was true, protons would be unstable and matter would ultimately be unstable. So you build a detector, you put a lot of water underground, okay, because water is H2O, hydrogen and oxygen, and so there are lots of protons there. If you have a bunch of molecules, maybe one or two or three will decay, and you can measure that signal, right? So they built up this detector, and the proton did not decay. They built a bigger detector, so they went from Kamiokande to Kamiokande 2, and the proton didn't decay. So basically, what is this telling you? Well, it's telling you that the proton is not decaying, right, essentially. But on the other hand, they found all these neutrinos coming through as well and being counted in these detectors. So what was a proton decay detector became a neutrino detector, okay? And now we use these detectors to study what we call neutrino astronomy. So these neutrinos come from stars, from exploding stars, and we can use that. Those are very different from the dark matter detectors that you mentioned before. So, and dark matter is a very different thing from protons and neutrinos as well.
You know, what you're telling me is, again, going back to what we were discussing right at the beginning of our discussion, that a lot of these things are things that we cannot see unless we have special tools now. And as our tools develop, we can see more and more, larger and larger, or smaller and smaller. But how does this kind of knowledge and this search for a never-ending search for knowledge affect us as humans and the human condition?
Well, it affects us in a very deep way because essentially as we try to understand nature, as we try to understand the composition of matter and the universe, what we're really trying to do is understand who we are. What are we made of? Where do we come from? What is our place in the cosmos? So science is very much part of this deeply human urge to find meaning in existence, you know, to try to understand the different roles that we humans can have in this very complex universe. So in that sense, science is a very deeply human and, I think, wonderful manifestation of our urge to have meaning and to find meaning in life.
Marcelo Gleiser is a professor of physics and astronomy at Dartmouth, and his latest book is called The Island of Knowledge, The Limits of Science and the Search for Meaning. Professor Gleiser, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Before we let you go, though, I have one more big cosmic question for you. As somebody who was born and grew up in Brazil, who's going to win the World Cup?
Oh, boy. That is a very hard question. You know, Nate Silver, who is so good in elections, said Brazil is by far the favorite, but seeing what I have seen so far, I'm not very convinced. I think soccer is very much like quantum physics. It's deeply unpredictable.
All right. Well, good luck to your team and to everybody else who's rooting for a team. Marcelo Gleiser, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Coming up, we're going to get to know the progressive running for Lieutenant Governor, Dean Corin. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. This week, we are getting to know the major party challengers for the state's top two offices. Republican Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott will face two opponents in the fall election, and my next guest is one of them. Dean Corin is the Progressive Party's candidate for Lieutenant Governor. Welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you, Jane.
So Phil Scott is a fairly popular incumbent. Why would you do a better job than him?
Well, we're aimed in different directions. I'm motivated to run in this race because we are on the precipice of passing implementing a healthcare system that will make a huge difference in Vermonters' lives. And we're at a point in time where we have some good legislation on the books, and we have a leader in the governor who is not only supportive of it, but who is leading the way. And it would be great if our other general policy statewide office, the lieutenant governor, was pulling in the same direction and working shoulder to shoulder. And I think there's an opportunity to do that. It's going to make a huge difference in the health and the economy of Vermonters' lives. And I don't see the present lieutenant governor doing that. And I think there's an opportunity to do that.
You've been supportive of single payer for more than a decade now. The governor, though, who, as you say, is moving forward with a single payer healthcare plan, has delayed coming up with a plan to finance it. Do you have a plan? How do you think it's financially viable for the state?
I don't have a plan that's in details and you know, 400 pages long, but I do have a set of principles that I've worked on in my entire tenure in the legislature and in other political work and policy work, and those principles are very straightforward in terms of fairness and in terms of gradual transitions from where we are now to where we want to be for funding our own healthcare system. Right now, of course, we're in a hodgepodge of our own and in the federal government, and we're embedded in that, and it's very complex and very unfortunate. And we have to start from those flows of money pretty much and make gradual changes so that we're not hurting any segment of the population or of our economy. And so I expect those principles to be embedded in what the governor does come out with later this year or the beginning of next year. And I would weigh in on modifying them in ways that I think make sense and commenting on them and having an effect in a positive way on making them as fair and as sustainable as possible.
But this is probably going to be one of the sticking points in the campaign as well. And in the campaigns, you know, throughout elected offices, how do we pay for this? You know, in theory, fine, but how do we actually pay for it? And, you know, any concrete examples that you have, having worked on this in the legislature and thinking about it over the last decade, I mean, it just seems like there's a big question right now. And even legislators, we got a note from Cynthia Browning, who's a representative from Arlington, who's concerned about the approach. So how would you alleviate concerns that this is something that is financially viable?
Sure. Well, first of all, I wish it was only a decade, but I wrote the first single payer bill in the early 90s.
Like two decades, yeah.
So that was a long time ago. The main thing that people have to remember is that we're paying for it now. And the analyses show that by moving to single payer, or what I think might be better termed comprehensive healthcare, aside from universal, which means you're covering everybody, but comprehensive meaning you're getting your hands around all of the costs. That's the only way we're going to control costs. And most of the analyses show we would save $500+ million in Vermont by moving to single payer. So understanding that we're paying for it now, we're paying for it through payroll taxes, income taxes, we're paying for it primarily through premiums. And all of that would be much simplified ultimately. But in the meantime, and ultimately it will not be based on your employer. So you'll be free to move jobs, free to do what is most economically sensible for you and will help the economy of Vermont in other ways that are even beyond the cost of healthcare that are suppressed right now. That's the most important fact. We will be paying less for healthcare than we would be paying otherwise under the current system. Exactly how much comes out of a payroll tax, exactly, and you know which employers are treated in what way, depending on their size, and how much comes from the income tax and the other various flows, and trying to remind people that you're no longer cutting a check for those insurance premiums. All that has to be factored together, and it's obviously much more complex than that also. So it's not something that I'm going to come out with an entire plan because that would just sit on the shelf. So, but obviously, I will have input into the governor's plan and what's going on in the legislature.
I'm speaking with Dean Corin. He's a Burlington businessman running as a progressive for lieutenant governor. He was elected to the legislature in 1992 and served until 2000. Dean Corin, the job of lieutenant governor has only a few delineated roles. So how would you structure the job to further your goals?
That is true. The lieutenant governor presides over the Senate, fills in for the governor when the governor's not around, and does a few other minor tasks, and yet has the opportunity to weigh in on a policy level and on a people level with everyone in the state of Vermont, in every corner of the state of Vermont. And I think that I would be far more active in pushing the development and the explanation and the feedback from the communities about healthcare. But then on a range of other issues, I would also be far more present in every corner of the state, not just cutting ribbons, but really listening to people and putting forward policy objectives that I can work with the legislature on and the governor on.
What about policy objectives in the realm of renewable energy and our energy portfolio? You work in renewable hydrology technology. What do you see as the right portfolio for the state of Vermont?
Right. My actual work is in renewable energy and energy a little bit broader than that also. the wonderful thing about Vermont is that we have opportunities to seize in renewable energy and also in energy conservation. It's not quite as sexy, but it is definitely where a lot of the money is and a lot of the money we export out of our economy that we could be keeping in our economy and employing people here. And we've done a lot in terms of conservation. There's a lot more to do, though. And so there's a lot of investment that needs to go into that that can also leverage private investment. That will be a big boon to our economy. And that really needs – we have just scratched the surface so far. On renewable energy, we have a lot of resources of our own in terms of hydro that we're already using to the extent that we can pretty much, although there's some slight redevelopment there. But we have tremendous capability for wind. And we're way behind the rest of the country on using wind power. We've had a couple of governors who were opposed to it. That's no longer the case. But we're also set behind in terms of planning in a way that makes people feel comfortable that we're not going to develop every ridgeline throughout the state of Vermont and ruin a lot of our values there. So we've really got to pull together and make a plan, something that our society is not that good at doing. Sometimes we set some good rules and laws and regulations, and sometimes we should be planning and looking forward. And we can do that in a way. We pull everybody together who's involved, who cares from an environmental, energy point of view, economy point of view, and come up with a plan that will give people a lot more comfort as to what we'll develop and what we won't develop.
A couple of quick questions while we still have you. You're in favor of a state bank. You have some tax policy goals. You'd like to see the state, quote, stop taxing workers' earned income at higher rates than investment income. Where's the daylight between you and Governor Shumlin, and are you going to be seeking his endorsement as you run?
The role of the Democratic Party in terms of my race is really up to them. And as I have said to everybody who's asked, if I get endorsed by the Democrats or if people write me in their primary, I'd be extremely happy to accept their support. And I think that between the progressives and the Democrats, we have the majority of the state far and away, and we'll give this race a strong shot. There are plenty of areas in which the governor and I will disagree, and to the extent that that Vermonters don't like electing a governor and a lieutenant governor from the same party. I'm giving them an opportunity to do that with a slight more movement to the left than what they've had, which is a tug to the right and really inaction on some of these key issues that Vermonters need in their families.
You've also secured public financing for your bid for lieutenant governor. Why was that something that you felt was important to do?
I felt it was critically important to try, because if we succeeded and we had a very short amount of time to do it, it would show that we have a great grassroots statewide group of people ready to volunteer at a moment's notice. And boy, did they step up. And I was just thrilled with the support from around the state, from people who are partisans and nonpartisans, Democrats and Republicans, as well as progressives, and just incredible feedback. We did it in by far a record amount of time. And it also gives us now the resources to run a full-blown, very competitive campaign, no matter how much money the Republican raises from private interests. They will not outspend us 5-1 or 10-1.
That's Dean Corin. He's the progressive candidate for lieutenant governor. Thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Jane.
Tomorrow, we'll hear from the other challenger in that race, Marina Brown of the Liberty Union Party. Bob Kinzel will also be speaking with the Republican gubernatorial candidate, Scott Milne. The Pomfret businessman says he wants to focus on education and how to pay for it. We'll hear Scott Milne's other priorities, and if you have a question for him, write to vermontedition@vpr.net and tune in for both interviews tomorrow at noon. We're produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing, with production assistance from Catherine Hayes. Mary Williams directed the program, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. And today we say goodbye to our dear colleague, Tim Johnson. For the last 7 years, listeners have called into Vermont Edition and have been greeted by Tim. He's probably the friendliest call screener in the business. In addition to his work on Vermont Edition, he's been VPR's online producer since 2005, creating many of the web pages you read every day. We are really going to miss Tim. VPR's loss is Arizona's gain.